Hello, world travelers and diners. Welcome to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning. Peter's expressing a degree of frustration just now. If his voice sounds a little terse, it's because he started producing the program and forgot to save it, so we're doing a do-over. So we're producing this program for the second time, and hopefully we'll get it right. And we'll do it the same as we did the first time.
Right.
There's probably about no chance we'll say the same thing as we did before, but...
Yeah, but I started by saying that we get a lot of culinary subject books.
You actually remember what we said just a few minutes ago. It's really remarkable.
And products. And we do the individual interviews, and then we stitch them together for these shows. The interviews are frequently by phone, and we have a lot of them to cover that we haven't previously run.
Yes, we do.
So today, we're going to do that.
So today we decided we would have a mélange for you. So,
yes.
So unlike last week when we were entirely in Western Australia, we're gonna jump a little bit all over the map today. We're going to
a little of this, a little of that.
Yeah, we're gonna have a definitive cookbook author, first of all, who knows everything there is to know about baking and has written a book about it, so that you can know that too. Then we're gonna change track altogether and talk to some old friends who are the new avant-garde of restaurant designers. They're architects called Avroco. So there we go there next. And then let me see what did we decide on. And after that, we're gonna do some wonderful new products, which crossed our doorstep and crossed our palates very recently, and we thought you should know about them. So that's...
Well, let's start off.
So that's roughly what's going to be in today's program.
The definitive cooking book.
Right. And it's an author
called... The baking, I mean.
Definitive baking book. The author's name is Wayne Gislin, and here he is.
Wayne Gislin, welcome to On the Menu.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Great to be here.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about your book, Professional Baking, 5th Edition, which is a thick, heavy, complete encyclopedia of what you need to know to be a professional baker. Is it a textbook?
Well, it is a textbook, but it's great for anyone who wants to understand how baking works, rather than just have a collection of recipes. It's nice to know if you're making recipes, how they work, why they work, why the instructions say what they do say, why those particular ingredients were selected, what can you do if something goes wrong?
That's a good one, I think. Yeah. And this is the 5th edition.
The 5th edition. The 1st edition came out more than 20 years ago. I think it was 1985.
For Le Cordon Bleu.
Well, not originally. Originally, it was a much smaller book, but it's been growing over the years. The Cordon Bleu has helped and contributed some material, but it's primarily my work.
Oh, it's a major undertaking. Now, why do we have a need for yet again another edition?
Well, there are always things that are... Well, first of all, I'm always trying to improve the book. And, you know, you never really... When you're trying to perfect something, you never really finish. So there are always improvements that I can make. Second of all, there were a number of new subject matter that I wanted to add. Most prominently in this edition, there is a new chapter on baking for special diets.
Which is
for example,
increasing like crazy.
I'm sorry?
It's increasing like crazy. I don't know how many cases of gluten intolerance and is coming down the pike.
Yes, and actually, I mean, it's been documented that cases of food allergies are really on the rise.
But why?
Well, I'm not sure that's really well understood. But for bakers, this is something that needs to be addressed, and there are certainly many people who would love to enjoy baked goods, but who can't eat gluten, or who are allergic to one product or another, or at the other end of the spectrum, simply want to cut down on, say, fats and sugars. So people are looking for lower fat products, lower sugar products. And so I tackled this, how a baker approaches modifying recipes for special diets.
Yeah, we have a bakery that does gluten-free.
And the question is, after you've done all that, do they still taste good?
Well, we try to do the best job we can. Again, for a baker, what a baker considers when modifying a recipe is the functions of the ingredients. when you're cooking on the stove, you have a lot of leeway in as to what ingredients you put in the pan. But when you're baking, every ingredient has a structural function. For example, gluten is really the main structure builder in baked goods, especially in breads. So if you're going to remove gluten, you need to compensate by adding something else that fulfills the same structure, the same function. So in order to do that, you need to understand how ingredients work in baking.
Yeah, what would you add to replace gluten?
Well, you look for something else that does the same thing, such as eggs, for example. When I developed a new recipe for a new cake recipe, there were enough eggs in the formula that they were almost enough to compensate for taking out the wheat flour, the protein in the eggs. Not quite. When you have something like bread, on the other hand, the gluten supplies virtually all the structure. And what's usually used in baked goods to compensate is a product called xanthan gum, which is made from sugar.
Yeah, that's a popular ingredient for molecular gastronomy.
Yes, and it's used in really tiny quantities. First of all, it's flavorless, and about 0.5% is enough to apply the structure that you need.
Huh.
It's quite amazing. There's a yeast sandwich bread in the book in this chapter that has no wheat flour at all, and instead of a stiff dough like breads, it's made from a batter, but it looks just like a regular loaf bread when it's finished.
Now, how do you find out about all this, Wayne? I mean, how do you figure all this out?
Well, you know, you go back to the basics. This is really what the book is about. It's about the basics. It's about how ingredients work, about the characteristics of different ingredients. It's about how the various processes work, like what happens when you mix ingredients together to make a dough or a batter. There are a lot of things that happen in that mixture, and you need to understand what happens in order to control the process. This is what bakers do, and home bakers as well, if they want to understand how what they're making works. I mean, there's really nothing like understanding to take the fear out of doing something. And, you know, you just use the same basic understanding to attack all these new problems.
And will there be a sixth edition and a seventh edition and an eighth edition? Or?
Well, I hope so. I'm going to keep doing this for as long as I can, and I imagine there will be a sixth edition some years down the road.
Now, do you actually have a day job?
This is my day job.
This is your day job.
I do this full time. I have other books that I'm writing.
My goodness.
Right now I'm working on two other books. And one of them is the seventh edition of my first book, which is called Professional Cooking.
Oh, right.
So it's a full-time job.
Now, how did you expect that someone would use the book? I mean, it reads, in a sense, it's almost like a tutorial all the way through, a chapter and a subject that tells you what you'll know when you get to the end, and then there are questions at the end that you can check yourself out on to make sure that you really understood it. I mean, is that how you expect to use it, or is it more like a recipe book that people will pick up?
Well, that's really how it's designed to be used. I mean, it is used in schools across the country, and actually around the world is used. It's even been translated into a number of languages. But for the home user, I would expect it to be used more like a reference. So if you're interested in making cakes, you can read there are several chapters on cake making, and you can read those and understand the background and the functions, how cake mixing works, and use it as a reference. For example, when people are making cakes, they tend to go to the store and buy a mix, which is probably a fairly expensive way to buy sugar, when cake mixing itself is fairly simple and straightforward when you understand the process.
You suggest that it's okay that you can get really good results with a cake mix.
It depends on whether you want all the ingredients that are in a cake mix. The nice thing about doing it yourself is, number one, it's less expensive. Two, if you understand it, it's more fun. And it's really not that complicated. For example, a basic sponge cake is made in just a few steps. Whip whole eggs with sugar, fold in sifted flour, and put it in the pan. I mean, that's basic. That's the basic process. It's really not a complicated procedure. Once you understand it, you don't need to rely on mixes with various preservatives and stabilizers and other things.
Now, we've had a number of pastry chefs tell us that one of the things that's vitally important, though, about being a pastry chef and being successful is to make sure you have the ingredient quantities just right. So I'm guessing that your book is good for that.
Quantities need to be right, and the way you get them right is by weighing them rather than measuring them dry ingredients by volume. You know, I don't know how many times I've seen in recipe books a recipe for bread where it gives you a number of cups of flour, and then it tells you don't put all the flour in because, you know, the moisture content of the flour varies quite a bit, and you might not need it all. That's not the reason that it doesn't work. The reason is that measuring by volume is very, very inaccurate. One cup of flour can vary by more than an ounce up or down. So professional bakers always weigh everything, and it's you always get consistent results.
Yeah, that's probably why I'm a throw it in the pot cook, and I'm not a baker.
Yeah, well, you know, weighing is pretty simple nowadays with inexpensive digital scales. You just put ingredients on the scale until you get the weight that you want. There's really nothing to it. Pretty simple process.
Well, I mean, it's not. There's nothing to it, I guess. I mean, you have to take the time to weigh everything. So, if you just throw in a cup, it's a lot easier, I guess.
Well, you figure you have to put it in a bowl anyway, so why not put it in a bowl on the scale?
Okay. All right. So the system is you get yourself properly equipped with the right toolkit first of all.
Yeah. Yes. And for baking, the tools you need are some good pans, heavy duty baking sheets, for example. A mixer and an oven, and you can do most things with that.
Now, where do you come down on the issue of this silicone?
I'm sorry?
Silicone. I understand that my daughter-in-law who bakes, that you don't brown things well on silicone.
I can't quite hear what you're asking.
Silicone.
Silicone in pans, I think she's asking.
Oh, these pans. They work really well. They work very well. You don't have to grease and flour them. And as long as they're properly cared for, they're pretty durable. They save a lot of time.
Huh.
Or just using, parchment paper. Bakers use parchment paper for just about everything.
Right.
And that's really also saves a lot of time. You don't have to grease pans. The cleanup is a lot easier. It's a great tool.
You know, this book is so full of surprises. I just opened it to the historical background to baking.
Yes.
What about that? You say it's as old as the human race?
Well, the first, when people started growing foods, or even before that, when they started gathering foods in prehistoric times, they were gathering, they discovered that seeds of various grasses were very nutritious. And as far as anthropologists can figure, the first grain foods eaten by prehistoric people were pastes made out of ground by pounding between stones, grains, wild grains mixed with water, and that's what really was a staple food of early people.
So they were actually making bread, although they didn't call it that, I guess.
Sorry?
And so they were actually making bread in a way.
Well, they were actually making bread, really more like porridge at first. And then someone discovered that if you left some of this porridge on a hot rock, it turned into what we now call a flatbread. And then someone else discovered that if you let this porridge sit around long enough, wild yeast started to grow in it, and it got bubbly. And that's where the first sourdoughs started.
It really
goes back to prehistoric times.
Isn't it amazing? I always wonder how many dead prehistoric people there must have been who ate the wrong thing.
I guess trial and error could have poisoned a lot of people.
I guess so. Well, listen. If you're into baking, this is a book you absolutely got to have. It's called Professional Baking,
Fifth Edition.
by Wayne Gisselin. And Wayne, we thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today. And good luck with the next version. And you did gluten-free things for this one. I'm sure there'll be equally exciting editions when the next edition comes out.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for having me on the show.
It
was a delight.
Good luck.
We learn something every time everybody comes on, and we certainly learned something today.
Thank you for calling.
Bye.
Well, if you want to know the where's and why for's or whatever it's called of baking, get this book.
And of course, you can get it on our website on the OTM bookshelf to make it nice and easy and convenient for you. And if you're into baking, this is going to be an absolutely tremendous resource for you.
Exactly.
But now we're going to take another resource. We're going to
take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Let me give you our email address one more time. It's onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com.
And well, it's not one more time. We probably have some new listeners, so they don't necessarily know how to find us. But
anyhow, we'd love to hear from you.
And now we're going to take a different direction through our melange
this
of a Sunday.
This is a gorgeous, gorgeous book. But I think I say that in the interview. We're talking to Will at Avroco. You pronounce it better than I do.
Avroco? I don't know that I'm pronouncing it correctly.
I
think so.
Avroco.
Avroco. There you go. Trust me to get it right.
It's been a long time since we've talked to Avroco. We don't have the whole team here, but we are talking to William Harris. Hi, William.
Hello. How are you?
Okay. First of all, I think you should tell our readers, our listeners, I guess, who or what, I guess both of them, what and who is Avroco?
Avroco is a design and
is that the way you pronounce it? Avroco.
Avroco, yeah.
I always do it the wrong. Okay, Avroco.
you're pretty close.
Avroco.
Avroco is a design and concept firm. We're based in New York, and we're a very interdisciplinary design firm. We do everything from architectural interiors, restaurants, hotels. We do retail spaces. We do graphic design. We do some product design. So we've got our hands in quite a bit of different things.
Could you run through the principles and the special area, special interests?
Sure. There's four main principles, and we've got about 30 employees. But the four of us are obviously myself, Christina O'Neill, Greg Bradshaw, and Adam Farmery. And basically, years ago, we all met in school back at Carnegie Mellon University. And Christina and I were studying fine arts, and Greg and Adam were both architects. So we all went our separate ways for a bit, ultimately came back together, and so it's been a nice meld of disciplines for us to kind of tackle very holistically all of the projects that we endeavor.
And where did the name come from?
Well, Greg and Adam created a firm in the mid-90s called Avro Design, and Christina and I had partnered up and created a media and concept development firm called Co Media Studios. In about the year 2000, we started working together very closely, sort of reunited, and it was just such a great synergy, and we worked so well together that we decided to just squish the two names together and merge, and so that's where Avroco came from.
Okay, and the book now that we're going to be talking about is sumptuous. I don't know how else to describe it. And it's called Best Ugly.
Well, because you this is a different book. Just as foursome is a different group of people than you might meet ordinarily on the street. I think it's fair to say I wouldn't have said this is your this is not your grandfather's architectural firm.
No, I might agree with you. Best Ugly is our first book. We're very excited about it.
It means
based on one of our a term that we use to describe a lot of one of our principles actually of design that we utilize in our work, and that's basically what the book revolves around, both our principles of design and as it manifests in our New York design work, New York restaurant design work, I should say more specifically, which is what we chose to focus on.
Yes, so you outline six concept, six restaurants.
We do, we do. And Best Ugly is one of our principles and the title of the book, and that essentially is a term we picked up while traveling around China. We were in being toured around a very beautiful manicured garden at this artist colony, and our host was taking us around to these beautiful pieces around the garden, and then there was just one very, very strange, odd, but very beguiling tree, and the term that he was best able to translate to describe it was Best Ugly. So it was funny, isn't it? Because it was ugly, because it was not unique, it was non-traditionally beautiful, and it had an extreme amount of character, and so we adopted that as a term for a lot of what we value in design aesthetics and how we approach a lot of our work.
A little quirkiness, no?
Absolutely. Something that's a little left of center, a little surprising. Again, just not traditionally beautiful. Something that's a bit more, non.
It seems, William, that you're giving away some of your sort of inner selves in this book. I mean, this is not your typical Architectural Digest kind of book about a beautiful interior or a beautiful exterior. It's really a different kind of thing. Can you explain that?
Sure. I appreciate you saying that, because we really did want to open ourselves up and rather than just have a purely glossy, photo heavy coffee table book, we really wanted to show ourselves and our thinking and our process, and really be honest about how things came to be and what struggles and what constraints we had and get a little gritty and honest in how we presented the projects and we wanted to take the veneer off of the process a bit and show the underbelly, and so it's something we always crave in meeting other architects or designers or people we admire or it's something that we always crave in other books that we see, and so it's just something we really wanted to do. And
now, do you think it has a positive or a negative influence on whether you get hired to do a project? I mean, that after all is rather important, and that's typically the glossy part of any architectural project is the wonderful things that are done before the building starts.
Right.
And you're starting off from entirely the opposite direction, saying, listen, it's going to be a little bit of a mess. Here's how we worked out our way out of all these different messes. Here's how we put a unique Avroco type signature on this building. What do you do? Put a book down in front of somebody and say, are you interested in working with us or not?
Well, that's a very interesting question. You know, from the get-go, we were always very clear, and for ourselves to state that this wasn't going to be a portfolio project. You know, this book wasn't meant to take the place of our portfolio, how we present our work. But at the end, it still really does, because I think that just as when we meet with a new client or when we talk amongst ourselves about one of our own self-propelled projects, we are very upfront and honest, and there is a real, I think this book really does show a kind of, an honesty and an ability to at least expose how we work around different challenges and obstacles when they come up. So in a way, even though it's not as slick and glossy, it really is sort of a testament to how we've been able to, have at least a little bit of success here and work around some pretty big challenges. So I think new clients have tended to really appreciate that, and I think it's been very, very helpful for us.
Who do you think is the audience you were aiming for with this book?
Well, anyone that's interested in architecture, especially, hospitality or restaurant design. It really gets deeper into a lot of the holistic thinking that goes into restaurants from...
Yeah, why are you so... you're really involved with restaurants. Are you really compelled to design restaurants?
Well, it was, we own and operate... One of our first projects was our own restaurant here in New York City called Public Restaurant.
Yeah, which we've been to and love.
And you guys have, of course. Yeah. You guys have visited there and had dinner and drinks with us several times,
and the Monday Room we've been to,
and the Monday Room as well. Yeah, a little wine bar right up to the side. So it's always been a passion, and it's always been a medium where many of our artistic inclinations and passions can really come together and shine, from just the general concept and art direction to being involved in the food and the graphic design and just the general environmental kind of experience. experience that we create. So it's definitely is the praxis of a lot of our passions.
Well, you're an exciting group. I mean, I remember it was probably one of the most challenging interviews we ever had.
Well, hopefully this one will be a little easier because, there are four of us, and we definitely all have our own opinions, and, we're always continually talking over ourselves. And
Yes, you are. Remember, we asked one person a question, and somebody else answered it. So it's sort of like you're a single creature with eight arms, eight legs, and probably eight mouths.
We all kind of share the same brain in our own twisted ways, but yes, hopefully this one will be easier.
Here's a question for you. I mean, I like to challenge you just a little bit here. I mean, let's suppose that you finished a design project for a restaurant and it's open, and diners go there. After all, a restaurant is about the experience of enjoying food and wine. So when people arrive and when they leave, do you want them to be impressed by the design, or do you want to let them be impressed by the food?
Well, that's a great question, and I certainly want people to comment favorably towards the design, but we also try and really respect the whole culinary endeavor and process and try to align ourselves with clients that have a really strong chef and a strong direction for the restaurant. And so, are very concerned, certainly, that people have a great food experience, because that really is what it's all about. You know, people are wanting a night out, but they're wanting, really good food, good wine, a good experience. And that's integral, So hopefully they come away with a favorable opinion of both, but certainly it wouldn't crush my feelings if someone didn't love the food but was raving about the design as well.
Well, that's fair enough. Fair. Now, have you had the experience of essentially strutting your stuff, your sort of different view of architecture with a client, and they turned you down?
It's a very collaborative process, really, and certainly there are clients that might not respond to a certain direction, and then that might be an overall global approach when we first start a project, or it might be, down to more specifics, certainly in details as we're moving on. So, we certainly try our best to kind of channel the goals and hopes of what our clients are looking for, and then put it through our filter and our spin. So
now, you used the term self-propelled projects just a little bit ago. Describe what you mean by that, and not all the in this book were self-propelled, only public, right?
No, exactly, only public. Well, self-propelled projects are projects that we generate and fund and design and follow through purely ourselves. So there's no, I guess you could say, external client. And, because of that, and this is kind of really dovetails into Peter's question as well, that it really does take any and all constraints, or it really frees us to do 100% what we want to do as a group, as Avroco. So, those projects are very dear to our heart, and we generally take on about one of those a year. Another year, it was some residential development.
And you're headed towards hotels, I read.
We are headed towards hotels,
which is a natural. You're a very sociable group.
We are.
I'd like to work at Avroco.
Well, it's fun. It's a very there's a lot of great disciplines that can all merge in those kind of lifestyle and experiential moments, and hotels are a great hub for that. And that's also why, we've gotten into things such as furniture, and we're even dabbling in some fashion design right now, too.
Oh, really?
So, yeah.
Is that because of this the social? The Stanton Social?
The Stanton Social? Well, play around a little bit in that, and we have started to get into a bit of either uniform design or more particular details along that nature in other restaurants, and it's started to just really dovetail into the whole lifestyle direction.
I keep looking at this. I have this page open to a Stanton Social illustration, and it's a corset. It's beautiful, isn't it? I mean, for design elements and so forth.
There were so many rich references and elements to mine when we were doing the Stanton Social. It was all based on the history of the garment industry, and as it related to the Lower East Side, and so there was just great turn of the century pieces, old suits, old corsets, things that we scoured the tri-state area for, and then dismantled and deconstructed and, you know, analyzed the details and tried to, in a very subtle way, reconstitute and reconstruct into the space. So that was a lot of fun. So
there are a lot of, listeners, there are a lot of surprises in this book, including Thomas Edison's rather bizarre experiments with AC and DC. But we'll just leave that inside the covers to encourage people to pick up this book and read it.
I don't know
if you saw that. It probably doesn't really belong on the air anyway. But if you want to know all about how Thomas Edison, who was an early tenant of the building where Public now is, propelled interest in his inventions in the world of electricity, it's on, I forget what page it is, and it's really a little bizarre.
And some mild abuse of local horses, but that's all we'll say about that.
There you
right?
go. Now, let's just go through a list of the,
well,
of the projects.
First, I have a question,
please.
I want to know, what does this term, because you have a lot of terms, you know, that and they're rife with meaning, but they're a little bit complex to grasp. Tell me what design connectivity means.
Design connectivity for us, and a lot about what this book is generally about, is really saying that, you know, before we even get into floor plans, picking materials, any of the real, you know, sort of obvious practices of design, there really needs to be a strong concept and a strong psychology and a strong core to, you know, defining the project and moving forward. And when we're able to design that concept, that concept will then later connect all of the pieces that umbrella covers. So that design connectivity truly has to run through from every material to, you know, concepting the floor plans to, you know, uniforms and graphics and, you know, specialty serving units for the kitchen and everything. So design connectivity for us is really saying, you know, really explaining how important to us it is to get that backbone, to define it early on, and to make sure that becomes the roadmap for the life of the project.
Hey, that's very good, Will. You explained that very well.
Oh, well, thank you. I hope that was coherent.
it's probably because it's really truly how you work, and that's probably the answer.
That's what makes
it really
your,
is.
That's
it's
what
the,
makes
it's
your
the core.
Business.
Yeah.
So no BS. No BS here. Avrico is just, this is just the way they are. This is a really fascinating book. You might just, William,
yeah,
in conclusion,
you, I yield
just,
the floor. You can
just,
have him do
just
that.
run down the list of the individual places that are in the book, and just a quick note about where they are. I think they're all in New York City, so that they're places that people can go and see for themselves.
Wow, yes, absolutely. Well, foremost is Public Restaurant, and that is our baby. That's our self-propelled project that we own and operate, and with which our studios are right above, and that's in Nolita in New York. We've got Quality Meats, which is up in the 50s, which is a steakhouse. We talk about Sapa on 24th and 6th in New York, which is a French Vietnamese concept. Odea is down right on the edge of Little Italy, and that's a dark, sexy, more of a lounge space.
Yeah, I didn't even know that existed, actually.
Yeah, it's really, you know, a small little tucked away spot. The Stanton Social is that's the one we talked about with the fashion references. The European Union, again, East Village, that's more almost of a gastropub feel. And then, let me see, have I covered everything? Might be about it. I think that's six, right?
I think that is.
That's six. Well, listen, it's been wonderful to talk to you. I'm sure you've got to go off and do some more design connectivity. Please say hello to your colleagues, and we're sorry they weren't able to join us on today's program, and also, of course, our regards to Brad and his relatively new wife.
I will, and thank you so much for having me on, guys.
Relative new baby.
Really,
oh, he has a new baby, too?
And the new baby, yes.
Oh, there you go. There's yeah. More design connectivity.
Absolutely.
And the book, listeners, is you can click on it and order directly from our website. I think that everybody should have this. I mean, even if you're not designing anything, it's so stimulating.
You know what? I just realized also, I put a lot of new books up, but you've been hoarding this book, so you haven't given it to me, so it's not on the website yet, so I better get on with putting it on there so people can buy it there.
And
we'll,
you have to share.
Oh, okay.
William, have a great day, and thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for talking to us.
Thank you so much.
Okay, bye-bye.
And now, as Anne would say, it's time to take a pause for the cause, and we'll talk to you on the other side.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Remember, you can email us at any time at www.onthemenuradio.com. So I can do it just as well as Anne, even though my voice is a little deeper and I'm not nearly as well organized. But Anne organizes all kinds of fascinating guests for us, and the next gang, a company called Bar Height, has just a fascinating range of products. Where did you find them, sweetheart? Where did you find these guys?
I don't even remember. No, I don't remember.
They have so many products, so many labels.
Yeah, the other product we're going to be featuring is we've long dealt with Gustiamo.
Yeah, but let's get Bar Height out of the way first, because they've got a story of their own of all kinds of fascinating flavors and salts and things like that, which are part of my cooking larder right now, and we're having a wonderful time with them.
Hello to Eric Stubenberg,
yes.
Salt Sommelier, and Susie Bar Height. Bar Height's Foods. Is that the correct full name of your company?
That's the correct name of our company, Bar Height Foods, specialty foods.
Susie, you're obviously a Bar Height, and what is your title?
So it's a family business.
Okay, and you are a president or a CEO?
I'm president in product development.
Okay, you do product development too, because we have lots of questions about that. The first introduction we had to your company was through your gourmet salt lines. Now, what got that started, Eric?
It's an interesting story. I'll try and keep it short. I left the restaurant business and became a fifth grade school teacher.
Yeah. Masochist.
And I was looking for a way to make Christmas gifts, and use some of my chef experiences, find a way to make salt that's on my table better than what we were getting before, and it just all came together. All my past experiences just all came together and came up with this great little product.
Now let's explore just a little bit more what the product is, because they're flavored salts, and they're somewhat unusual flavors.
Yeah, well, they're actually, and I actually smoked them too. So what I did was, since Oregon's got such great regional products, that's what I really wanted to focus on. I took regional Oregon wines, I made reductions, introduced them to the salt, and smoked them at the same time so that the salt came out with these beautiful colors and rich aromas and nice smoky depths to them. And they bonded so well with the crystals. So, like, my Pinot Noir salt has just perfect little purple crystals. And then I looked at other things that are a little bit more regional, like the hazelnuts, and I can create the hazelnut infusion. And I love margaritas, so I made the Serrano lime salt to look for.
Now, is that what that's supposed to be? The margarita flavored.
The one that I found to be the most flexible and most interesting to add flavor. The Pinot, not that they're not all excellent, is the olive salt.
I really
found that to impart more of the flavor that I wanted than just about anything else.
It's a fantastic salt. You know, what I like about it is that it does go well with so many different dishes, because it gives you what you look for in an olive. You're looking for that kind of nice, rich, oily flavor with the dark, smoky, salty flavor at the same time, and it goes really well with, you know, chicken or pork or anything, even salads.
And now, there's only one I don't get, is the chocolate salt.
Well, the chocolate salt came about because I'm a big fan of South American foods, and the mole chocolate sauce is one of my favorites. And so I'm looking for a combination of savory and salty and sweet to be able to impart on other types of food. And I have a lot of chefs who like to use the chocolate salt on things like a deconstructed brownie. We put it over ice cream. This morning I had it over eggs. But it's one of those salts that it's unusual, but it has more smoky flavor to it, and it has a little bit more of a twist.
Now, you brought this idea to Barheit.
I did. Chris Barheit, Susie's son, and I went to college together at Oregon State for cultural restaurant tourism management, and I started this. I started making these salts, and different people wanted me to produce it so they could purchase it, and so I went to Chris, who's been so successful with the Barheit mustard line and the marinade line, and I asked him what I should do next, and he said, well, why not do it together? And I said, fantastic, let's do it together. And that's when I got a hold of Susie, and we started talking about different types of flavors.
Now, Susie, how did your company start?
My husband and I started it when our kids were quite young, but we did it just because we had a restaurant, and we're a small town in eastern Oregon, and at that time, we couldn't buy good quality mustards except in tiny little jars. So our family had some tradition in making mustards, and we started making our own mustards for the restaurant. People wanted to take it home.
Okay.
It accidentally grew.
Right.
So
a food company was born from that.
Right.
From
there you go. Now
it in a cup. What did you say?
No, I wasn't meaning to interrupt. Okay. I just wanted to interject that
that's how it happened.
So we took the garlic mustard south with us to a recent visit with our son and daughter-in-law, and we really enjoyed that.
And we're eating it out of the jar.
Let's see, the other one.
Good
that we,
for you.
The other one we liked, I think, was the beer mustard.
Uh-huh. That, I love that one. I just made some chocolate truffles, and I put some of that in there, and the truffles, and then I sprinkled them with the hazelnut salt.
Oh, what?
They
that
were
sounds
wonderful.
Fabulous. Are you going to go into the confection business, too?
So mustards were next. Now, what about all these marinades and sauces?
We just, as the company grew, playing with foods, knowing what lifestyles are today, people wanting to use healthy food, but coming home wanting it to be fast, I tried to make things that people could use that brought out great flavors and feel proud about serving, but made life.
Now, we're planning on wing sauce on the chicken I'm going to cook this evening on the barbecue grill. I'm not sure that Anne knew that yet.
I didn't.
Well, actually, I make a wedge salad with that and with blue cheese. It's really good.
Cool. There you go.
What would you normally, which of your products would you use on grilled chicken?
I like the cracked pepper marinade on steak and grilled
chicken.
We do,
yeah. We've used that, but what I was planning to do, I wasn't going to marinate in advance. I have used the cracked pepper one as a marinade, and it's been very successful. I think we've used it on pork a couple of times, and it's really worked out very well. I was just going to mop the chicken with the wing sauce and maybe one of the other sauces just to see how they go. I haven't used either one of them on the barbecue grill yet. So that's tonight's adventure. So we have a cut up whole chicken. And one of the food and wine sauces I want to try, because we tried it cooking something in the oven and it didn't seem to come through quite as well as we liked.
That was me.
So we're gonna
always brings out the flavor.
Yeah.
When I do it in the oven, I finish off with a little bit more sauce.
Okay. Maybe we just didn't have enough because
Anne cooked it and Peter went to taste the. And he said, I think this calls for carrot pickle. Now, this is something that's been in our refrigerator for probably 10 years at this point. It's so hot and spicy.
Hmm?
It's Indian pickle, carrot pickle. So, I mean, if it was that bland, I think that I did not do it right.
Maybe this is another product idea for you.
There it is.
Carrot
salt.
Actually, that's how we get just talking. It's amazing how ideas come, right. Where ideas come from.
Now, do you go to this fancy food show?
Yes, we do.
Are you going to be in New York?
Yes, we will be.
Oh, great! So,
are you going to be there?
Yes, indeed.
Well, I'll get to see you.
That would be great.
Now, part of the line, and Anne was asking before we started the interview on air that. You have some wines that carry a nomenclature for food and wine.
That's right.
Labels, yeah.
So
we've had a relationship with Food and Wine magazine for several years now. They came to us, and we developed some products working together for them, and they've been really successful.
What, do they sell products in addition to their magazine?
No, we sell the products. It just has their name on it.
Okay. I mean, who came up with the idea? Did they come up with the ideas, or was it just the power of food and wine?
It was collaborative.
Okay. That's great. Well,
do you sell online, right?
Yes, we do. Yes, you can find all the lines at barhide.com, and then you can also find it on amazon.com, and the salts you can find at Made in Oregon, and some of the sauce.
Yes, you can.
Are you also in retail distribution, Susie?
We are all over the country, but by calling 1-800-BAR-HEIGHT, we can tell you where retail stores are, and we also have a newsletter on our website that you can sign up for, and we have information there.
And it's spelled Barhyte, listeners.
That's correct, Barhyte.
And these are nice people, so get in touch with them.
This is good. This is
good
in
stuff.
in the words of On the Menu Radio. This is good stuff. and you should get some, and we've got lots and lots of salts and lots of sauces. So if we say it's at the top of the crop, then you can be sure that we're comparing that with an awful lot of other products. And the only thing we've got to do is we've got to try that food and wine marinade, the greenish one.
We got to
try that with a little bit more sauce and see if that does the trick.
And it's fabulous barbecue on the barbecue.
Okay, well, we're an infinite.
And on salmon.
Yeah, we're
on salmon.
Oh,
boy,
hey,
I
missed that one.
Yeah, well, I was a little bit doubtful about that one, but maybe we'll give that a try sometime.
Well, anyhow,
I think you'll be pleased.
Yeah, Susie, anything in the pipeline for future product?
We are always working on new products, and Eric's working on some wonderful new salts using Oregon berries. We've always got things in the pipeline.
I have a Oregon smoked honey habanero salt that's coming out.
Oh, that sounds good.
It's one of my favorites. I rim margarita glasses with those, of course. I actually have friends who put it on there. They make these, I don't know what you call them, beer-ritas, where they take the can of beer and they rim their beer with the salt and squeeze a little lime in them. And
yes.
One of those favorites.
Which sounds wonderful. And being from Pendleton, which is a Roundup cowboy town, we have the burritos are just suits the town perfectly.
Okay. Now, is this the town where the Pendleton clothing's made?
Pendleton clothing, and they're having their 100-year anniversary next year, and Pendleton Roundup's having their 100-year anniversary next year, which we're doing a cookbook for, and we. So we're inviting everybody to come to Pendleton. Pendleton Clothing is doing a big celebration, and they're doing it with the Roundup, so it's going to be fun.
Well, send us an invite. Email us an invite. The email is onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com.
And it's just been an absolute pleasure to talk with you all, and we hope you have a wonderful day in Pendleton in eastern Oregon. Again, www.barhyte.com. Get some.
That's right.
Thanks for having us.
And we've enjoyed it thoroughly.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Bye.
Bye. Now, I think that we're going to take a little credit for rather than discovering of Gustiamo. I mean, we beat the New York Times to having them on our program and talking about their wonderful product line. I think it probably was 4 years ago. But anyhow, they always have wonderful products. The two women they go into the backwaters of all over Italy and all these small towns, and they find these artists and producers, and we always end up with wonderful stuff. The latest we have is this red rice that we tried when we were visiting our son and daughter-in-law and granddaughter, which was absolutely startling on the plate, which I think I mentioned in the interview. That's what we're talking to Martina about. So let's just go to that interview.
You know, the funniest thing is the one thing I never asked Martina was, you know, we associate rice with the tropics. We're reading about the fact that the rice crop in the Irrawaddy Delta
in Myanmar is going to be destroyed, and that's destroyed as a result of the tropical monsoon. But here in Europe, rice is grown in the northern part of Italy.
And, yeah, well, you asked her about that.
Did I do that?
Yes, you did.
Oh, I did. I forgot that I did.
And did
she explain it?
Yes.
Then I guess we better go to the interview,
exactly.
And then we'll understand.
Exactly. Martina Kenworthy of Gustiamo.com gets to sample a lot of good food. Hi, Martina.
Hello, Anne.
We know Gustiamo very well. We interviewed Beatrice 4 years ago, I think.
Yes.
But you just sent us something that was so beautiful, so startling on a plate, and so delicious, and also so healthy. Tell us about this rice.
The red rice, and it's one of the products we carry that really has a history behind it, and we love the type of production the rice comes from. It comes from Piemonte, which is in the northwest of Italy. It's a region that is famous for wines, but especially for the production of rice, not only red rice. Because of the climate, because of the soil, of course, you know, rice needs a very moist soil, and so it's perfect, and some of our rice producers are in Piemonte. And so this one in particular is called Pacifico Crespi. It's a family-run company. They're really very small. They're only 5 people. They've been in the agricultural business for 6 generations. So we are talking 1800 when they bought the land and they started growing rice. But in particular, the red rice is a recent discovery. It's a spontaneous crossbreed of rice, of what they call indica variety. Apparently, one of the seeds came from India. And it was discovered by a farmer on the fields in Italy in 1980. So it's really just relatively recent.
You mean he just sort of suddenly saw this?
I'm sorry?
He just suddenly saw
this? Yes, he was walking on the fields, and when I heard this story, I thought it was so interesting how someone who was dealing with rice all the time, and, you know, their eyes are trained to really recognize just one little plant of rice, and he noticed the color was red.
Mm-hmm.
And he picked it up, and they discovered, and they tried to grow, and you know, there were several trials before they actually were able to have crops of red rice.
Well, this is absolutely beautiful. Now, the country where it grows, is this in the river? Is this in the valley of the River Po? I mean, I thought that's where all the rice was.
It's a little further north, but it's the same climate. It's a damp, kind of foggy during the winter month, and the rice has the production of the rice has seasonality. Usually, it's sowed in April, May, and then it's harvested in the fall when the weather is, you know, the typical weather of the north of Italy. So again, there's rain, there's water. The natural composition of the soil in Piemonte has lots of clay. And the clay actually retains some of the water and filters it so that it doesn't go bad for the rice to keep growing and developing. What's curious, I think, is that the red rice cultivation expanded west of Piedmont, of Piemonte. And now another region that produces a lot of red rice is Camargue in France.
Okay, yeah.
But the Italian red rice is supposed to be better because the health and food department in Italy is one of the strictest in Europe to make sure the rice crops are not contaminated by pesticides.
Oh,
and our producer, Crespi, is really very strict about it's a completely natural production.
Now, one of the most interesting things about it to us, aside from the fact that it has color, is that, in fact, it still has all the, what do you call it, the husk?
Yes.
On it, and that's what's red. When you get inside, the rice is the same color as every other kind
of
rice.
Exactly, yes. Yes, it's really the rice. A rice kernel has 3 shirts. It's what they call the shirts of the rice kernel, And the red rice, as once saved, in other ways, it's harvested, it's aged, and this crispy rice is aged for 1 month, which is a long time compared to industrial rice production. Of course, you know, they're trying to speed up all the steps just to get it on the market as fast as possible. They're larger production. But this one is aged in temperature-controlled silos, and after about 1 month, is cleaned, and the polishing of the kernels happens through stones. And this is another big... I think this really makes a difference in the way the rice is treated and produced, because most companies use nylon pistons to clean the rice, and this produces a overheating of the kernel, so you lose some of the qualities, the nutrients of the rice. But this one is polished by stones, and so it's minimally cleaned and preserves all the nutrients.
But the package that you sent us, which we sampled just last week, didn't it still have the husk on it?
Yes.
So you can actually get it both ways. Huh?
Exactly.
Why don't you, because you're the expert, I mean, we fixed it according to your specifications.
Yes, I think it was a recipe maybe with apples, but definitely the red rice for the quality, for the taste characteristic.
It's very nutty.
It's best with vegetables. And I spoke to our producer, you know, we're going back and forth all the time and trying to get inspiration about recipes and learn more about our products. And he said that this red rice with porcini mushroom, it's really an ideal combination because there's an earthiness to the flavor that marries the same character of the porcini. And so it's relatively easy to prepare. You can put it in water. If you want to, you can soak it in water before you start cooking it because of that husk that you were mentioning, Peter, before. The water penetrates gradually, and that will shorten the cooking time, which is about 40, 45 minutes.
We just followed the instructions on the package, and...
And it turned out...
It turned out beautiful. It was even...
Oh, good.
It was excellent... microwave warmed over the next day as well, but
yes.
we just added some olive oil to it and stirred that in, and then we grated some Parmesan cheese on top of it. That's all we did with it, and it was just an absolutely excellent side dish.
Definitely, it's the beauty of it too. I think that you can use it in more complex preparation, but you can definitely use it as a side dish to any other main course, and it looks beautiful. I think the color really adds something to the plate.
Yeah, it's very startling. Now let's make sure that people know where they can get this.
Sure, it's gustiamo.com. It's www.gustiamo.com, and we have a selection of artisanal Italian food. We are native Italians. We go to Italy all the time. We try to find products who are really unique and pure and produced away from industrial method of production. And it will be online, and you can just order it, and we ship anywhere in the United States.
Well, that's wonderful. Now, we'll be sure to say hello to your sister Beatrice.
I will, of course.
And I think we have some more exciting product coming down the pipe. So we'll be talking to either you or her again. And I guess we'll probably see you at the Fancy Food Show in New York, too.
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to seeing you there.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you, Anne.
And I just love all of your products.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
Have a good day.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, here we are again, and I think that we're concluding, we're getting close to concluding wide-ranging show, as usual.
Is that what they call a wrap?
A wrap, or it's in the can, which can be a dubious expression.
Yeah, I've never quite understood the allusions there.
Well, that's because they used to have reels of film.
I see. Okay, well, this is certainly not a reel of film, but it's in an electronic can.
Yes.
And you're listening to it coming out of the can. We hope you enjoyed it, and that you'll make a point of joining us at the same time, at the same place, with www.onthemenuradio next Sunday.
Till then, bye-bye.